you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Thanks for joining us here this afternoon. A special thank you to this young fellow over here, Jesse. Thanks a lot for standing up here. And also to Deb Callahan. Many of you may not be aware of it, but Deb Callahan led the efforts of the League of Conservation Voters for years, and what a spectacular job of leadership she has provided to all of us. Thank you. And another leader on the environment who has spent years and years fighting for change, served on the boards of the Environmental Defense Fund and Carnegie Foundation and others, and none other than my wife, Teresa, and I'm grateful for her leadership. Thank you. Thank you. And I'm very grateful to my colleagues in government for joining us here today. Thank you for taking time to be part of this. Here in Faneuil Hall, America's first great gathering ground of speech and dissent, we came together 2 months ago, and nearly 2.5 centuries after the voices of patriots were first heard in these very halls. We came together to affirm that the patriotism of 2006, no less than the patriotism of 1776, demands that we speak truth to power, that for love of country, we must end a war in Iraq that kills too many of our sons and daughters. A war that regrettably betrays both our national interests and our ideals. Last week in the Senate, we stood against appeals to politics and pride and demanded a date to bring our troops home. We did that because that's the way you get the Iraqis to stand up for Iraq and fight a more effective war on terror. We defied the White House tactics of fear and smear. Presidents and Republican politicians may be concerned about losing votes or losing face or losing legacies. Well, we told the truth because we're more concerned about young Americans and Iraqi civilians who are losing their lives. And I guarantee you, our plan for success would bring less loss of life, less expenditure of dollars, and it would make America safer. Now I say we, because even though our resolution only won 13 votes this time, I know that every minute of the debate, you were there with us. You were there with Russ Feingold, there with Ted Kennedy, and there with us as we voted your beliefs and ours that a policy based on a deception and filled with blunders is no excuse for its own perpetuation. But while we lost that roll call, I guarantee you that we will win the judgment of history because Washington is wrong and Americans are right, and we must set a new course for Iraq. Yet our challenge is not just to end this war. It is to prevent the next one. The arrogance of ideology and the willful ignorance of the intelligence that led us into a war of choice of Iraq is one thing. But now we must act so that at some future date, America will never have to fight for its economic security because we are permanently held hostage to foreign oil. We must make the hard choices, I mean hard, about alternative energy and clean coal, conservation and fuel efficiency, choices that will free our future from the dominance of big oil and yesterday's fossil fuels, a dominance that in the era of global warming threatens the future itself. So I... So I come here to Faneuil Hall, which is also the cradle of American independence, to set out a strategy for energy independence, to propose specific steps for an energy revolution as far-reaching as the Industrial Revolution, and to oppose the procrastination, the Washington evasion, and the Cheney-run secret task forces by and for big oil. How insulting and ridiculous it is to be told that the solution to our problems is to drill and destroy the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge that would yield a few months of oil at best, when we are already importing 60% of our oil and climbing. God only gave us 3% of the world's oil reserves. There is simply no way to drill our way out of this crisis. We have to invent our way out of it. To do that, we also have to invent our way out of the politics of greed and empty posturing that has worsened our dependence and denied the undeniable and potentially disastrous effects of global warming. Not long ago, in the face of record gas prices, a volatile Middle East, and a hostile rhetoric from the fundamentalist regime in Iran, a president of the United States asked, "Why have we not been able to get together as a nation to resolve our serious energy problem?" His name was Jimmy Carter. And that steamy summer of 1979 seems as familiar today as the question that he raised then. Almost 27 years later, we face another summer of record gas prices, raging violence across a volatile Middle East, renewed rhetoric of hate from a fundamentalist regime in Tehran. Our national neglect has made the quarter of a century since then what Winston Churchill called years the locust has eaten. Today we endure another summer of record gas prices. We witness the violence raging across the volatile Middle East, and we hear the same rhetoric. George W. Bush now says that America is addicted to oil. His preferred policy has been to feed the addiction. His attitude on greenhouse gases is to let them increase. His energy alternatives are token. And again, his approach to the crisis is to denigrate the environment. Mr. President, the people of America know the truth. America is not addicted to oil because it wants to be. Washington is addicted to oil because that's the way the powerful interests want it to be. And it has been this way ever since President Nixon announced a national goal that by 1980, the United States will not be dependent on any other country for the energy we need. That's a quote. President Ford extended the deadline, energy independence by 1985. Come 1985, President Reagan was promising to, quote, ensure that our people and our economy are never again held hostage by the whim of any country or cartel. The bottom line, whenever we face an energy crisis, talk of energy independence becomes the common currency of the American political dialogue. We have Apollo projects, Manhattan projects for alternative fuels, summits and conferences, and energy expos. And then, as the price of oil falls, or supplies increase, or we put a war behind us, the sense of urgency evaporates. Too often, our leaders in both parties have done what's easy, turned their backs on hard realities and great possibilities. Renewables, energy efficiency breakthroughs, clean technologies have been marginalized in the face of self-interested forces. In these lost years, my friends, we could have created millions of new jobs, opened up vast new markets, improved the health of our citizens, slowed global warming, saved the taxpayers' money, earned the respect of the world, and significantly strengthened our long-term security. Instead, America's energy strategy has been rhetorical, not real. For evidence, look no farther than the fake energy bill Congress enacted over bipartisan objections, a monstrosity with no national guiding goal, no tough decisions, no change in priorities, just a log-rolling, back-scratching collection of subsidies for any industry with the clout to get a seat at the table and a share of the pork. A few good ideas, a lot of bad ideas and ugly ideas, Washington smiled equally upon all of them. Now, I don't know how to say it more plainly. Washington's energy policy is as real as their claims of mission accomplished in Iraq. But it is also the latest chapter in the long story of both parties' politics at its worst. Ducking the difficult choices, giving in to the big contributors, substituting words for deeds, postponing the reckoning until the day after tomorrow. If you offend no one, you change nothing. Well, the world is changing, and now the reckoning is real. Last Thursday, Brian Williams opened the nightly news with a stark statement, quote, "Top climate scientists are saying with a high level of confidence that the Earth is the hottest it has been in 400 years. NBC's science department correspondent reported that global warming may lead to, quote, rising sea levels, heavy rains in some areas, drought in others, and an increase in severe weather, including hurricanes. Was there room to argue? Well, as the NBC story concluded, quote, "You can always make a debate if you can find one scientist who says the Earth is flat and have him debate it against everybody else." Well, my friends, Washington is full of flat Earth politicians. No matter how the evidence has mounted over two decades, the melting of the Arctic ice cap, rising sea levels, extreme weather, the Flat Earth Caucus can't even see what's on the horizon. In the Congress, they've even trotted out the author of Jurassic Park as an expert witness to argue that climate change is fiction. This is Stone Age science. Here's the bottom line. Within the next decade, if we don't deal with global warming, our children and grandchildren will have to deal with catastrophe, global catastrophe. It is time to stop debating fiction writers, oil executives, and flat earth politicians and actually take on the other mortal threat to America after terrorism, which because of our oil dependence is a decisive front in the war on terrorism. We simply can't respond to global climate change, and we can't wage and win a real war on terror if we don't at least take bold, real steps towards energy independence. For too long, we have allowed fundamental problems in the Middle East to fester by signaling corrupt Arab regimes that we don't care what they do so long as they keep the oil flowing. So energy independence is more than an important economic policy. It is an indispensable element of our national security. Our reliance on oil not only props up decaying and dictatorial regimes, but those that tolerate and sustain terrorist groups. Any long-term strategy for winning the war on terror must be matched with a determined effort to reduce our dependence on petroleum. It demands an international response linked to the rapid emergence of new energy technologies in order to ensure that emerging economies don't become the new enablers of Middle East autocrats. Make no mistake, our long-term mission in the war on terror depends on the long-term energy independence. We must end the empire of oil, period. For some, it may be hard to conceive of a world where fossil fuels, and especially petroleum, are not the dominant sources of fuel, as much as we will need them well into the future. In fact, we've been here before. 150 years ago in Massachusetts, in New Bedford, in Nantucket, no one could conceive of a future that didn't depend on whale oil. But until recently, America's history has been to drive technology, transform marketplaces, and invent a future never imagined before. In America, making the impossible possible has been a credo and a way of our life. In the 1930s, only 10% of America, rural America, had electricity. Utilities refused to wire rural counties because homes were too far apart. So to bring electricity to all Americans, Congress provided more than $5 billion to finance rural electrification. By the 1950s, there was hardly a corner of America that was still dark. Across our history, we've moved successfully from wood to coal, coal to oil, oil to a mix of gas, oil, coal, nuclear, hydroelectric. Now it is time to move to solar, wind, biomass, fuel cells, clean coal, and other wonders of American technology. And I believe deeply that Washington must lead the marketplace in the right direction. Today, there is as compelling a national interest to address the security and environmental threats of fossil fuels as there is to defeat radical extreme Islamists and global terror. Our soldiers shouldn't be the only ones called to sacrifice in this war. We must all be soldiers, and we must all welcome some sacrifice in that service. As individuals, the change can be as simple as replacing traditional light bulbs with efficient fluorescents. In our communities, we should require that new buildings include lights that turn off when people leave the room. We should follow the lead of Tokyo and their energy-efficient escalators that actually shut off when they're not being used. There are literally thousands of things to be done, too few of which we are being asked to do. Each of us can do something. And together, all of us can insist on leaders who secure our energy independence. You know, we wouldn't elect a candidate who said terrorism wasn't a threat. We wouldn't tolerate a candidate for national office who didn't say he was committed to capturing or killing Osama bin Laden. But for too long, we've tolerated those who treat the threat of energy insecurity and the truth of global climate change as an inconvenient myth. Well, from now on, every American who walks into a polling place can and should vote to kick out anyone who stands in the way of energy independence. But it's also time to put Washington to the test. Time to tell powerful interests that the old era has ended and so have their easy arrangements. Then instead of empty slogans and long laundry lists of bite-sized ideas that tinker at the edges of an outdated policy, we can embark on revolutions that will put our energy future in our own hands and put global climate change at the top of the national agenda where it belongs. So today I want to focus on three big steps that are imperative to addressing global warming and transitioning to dependence on homegrown sources of energy. First, I believe we need to establish an oil goal and implement an aggressive set of policies to reach it. Second, I believe we must immediately expand the availability, production, and distribution of renewable fuels to run our cars. And third, we need to get serious about climate change and take measures to freeze and reverse our greenhouse gas emissions. To start, we have to establish mandates for reducing U.S. oil consumption by 2.5 million barrels of oil per day by 2015, an amount equivalent to the oil we currently import from the Persian Gulf. Yes, I said mandate. And I said it because we've lost too much time for voluntary measures to be put to the test. And we can't just set a mandate. We have to provide incentives to businesses and industry to make the mandate achievable. We must significantly ramp up our production of flex fuel vehicles. These are the vehicles that run on alternative fuels like E85, a blend of 85% ethyl alcohol, a homegrown, domestic, completely renewable source of fuel that burns cleaner than gasoline. Other countries already know something that we don't. Actually, they've been doing something that we won't, something influential interests don't want us to do. 30 years ago, when Brazil faced an energy crisis, they got serious about alternative fuels. Relying on new stocks of homegrown fuels, in addition to its own oil production, this year Brazil will achieve energy independence. If Brazil can do it, why can't we? If a developing country... If a developing country can go from 90% dependence on foreign oil to 0% in 3 decades, then we, the most powerful, creative, industrial country on earth, we can change the destructive course that we're on. Today, in this country, only 6 million vehicles, just 10% of all those on the road, can be fueled by E85. And less than 1% of the service stations in America have even a single E85 pump. To change that, we must require, not just recommend, require that an increasing percentage of new cars can run on E85, and that by 2020, all new cars will have the capacity to run on E85. Or some similar clean fuel that technology provides us as we rush down the road. 2020, folks, that's not just a vision. That's a real program to jumpstart energy independence. But building these cars doesn't get you there, doesn't get you very far, if there's nowhere for Americans to fill them up. What a Washington solution it would be if we built fuel flex cars, but you couldn't buy the fuel. Talk about a bridge to nowhere. So we need to immediately expand our investment in the E85 infrastructure. Mandate that 10% of all major oil company filling stations offer at least one ethanol pump by 2010. And to deploy this technology quickly, provide financial incentives to both independent and retail chains to install the new pumps. Just think, folks, we could put ethanol pumps in every single gas station in America for what we spend in Iraq in just 1 week. I don't think there's a member of Congress who will want to tell their constituents that they didn't think breaking our dependence on oil was worth as much as 1 week in Iraq. When the energy spending bill comes to the floor before the Senate, I will offer an amendment to get over 1,800 E85 pumps across the country in the next year alone. And with your help, we will make the Congress vote yes or no, choose the status quo, or choose America's energy future. To ensure that we have enough ethanol to meet our demands, we must also invest in the kind of ethanol produced from plant wastes and energy crops like switchgrass. And we must set a goal of having 30% of our fuels come from biofuels by 2020. Believe me, if we're spending $2 billion in Iraq in 1 week, surely we can commit $2 billion in funding for cellulosic biofuels over the next 10 years. Energy efficiency can be a powerful weapon in the arsenal of our democracy and as indispensable as armor or munitions. We have to combat the threat to soldiers that comes not just from gun barrels, but from oil barrels. We should all be incensed that we are, in effect, financing both sides of the war on terror every time we fill up our tanks. We can't keep asking American troops to risk the ultimate sacrifice in Iraq or elsewhere in the world if those of us on the home front aren't ready to even make the smallest step, the smallest sacrifice to help them. I remember sitting with a top CEO from the auto industry in the spring of 2003. He'd come to see me to talk about the automobile efficiency standards that Senator McCain and I were fighting for. I asked him why the American auto industry seemed unwilling to build more fuel-efficient vehicles. He told me that the American consumer wouldn't buy a more fuel-efficient car. He asked me, quote, why in the world would we change everything to build more fuel-efficient vehicles when no one wants them? 3 years later, as the demand for high-mileage vehicles soars, the Japanese are there in the market, and our own companies are struggling to catch up and even survive. With leadership in Washington, through a combination of incentives, grants, and standards, we can and must at last revolutionize the way we drive in America. We must no longer be afraid of the third rail of energy policy, fuel economy standards. Fuel efficiency standards have been essentially unchanged since 1980. Think about that. Jimmy Carter was president. My daughters were playing Atari and wearing leg warmers. Apartheid was a way of life in South Africa, and America was tuning in to find out who shot JR. Since then, because Washington stood still, captive to powerful interests, The average efficiency of American vehicles, average, has actually declined. The United States can't have a serious policy for oil security until we leave the 1980s behind, entering the 21st century by demanding a major increase in the fuel economy of our cars. Massachusetts and California have led the way, cutting CO2 emissions from cars, leading the way for more efficient cars in these states. But state action alone can't meet this national challenge. Washington must do its job, too. We need to establish a federal standard for controlling carbon dioxide emissions from cars and trucks. And if the entire country did what Massachusetts and California are already doing, we could raise fuel efficiency by 40% right there. Building the cars of the future. Fuel-efficient, advanced technology vehicles will require automakers and their suppliers to retool their factories. I believe we have a responsibility to help make that happen. I believe the federal government has a responsibility to help them remain competitive. The jobs matter. Tax credits will help support the necessary investments, make the new technologies cost-effective, and create jobs for the workers who will build the cars of the future and help consumers to buy them. We should commit $3 billion to this effort in tax credits over the next 5 years. Tax credits that will not only help reduce oil dependence, but which will pay for themselves with the tax revenue generated by the growth and the productivity that will follow. But like all the funding in my proposal, let's not leave it subject to the whims of Congress and an army of appropriators. We need to create a security and conservation trust fund to guarantee the resources will be there to move our nation towards energy independence. This isn't a matter of dreaming. It's not a matter of capacity. It's a matter of willpower. We have the money. The question is whether we have the right priorities. Just by rolling back the tax breaks for big oil, which even President Bush apparently opposes, and by renegotiating oil leases, we can invest in a fund for energy security for America's future. And instead of a tax code that works so effectively for K Street lobbyists, let's provide an aggressive set of tax incentives and grants to assure that by the year 2020, 20% of all passenger cars and trucks on the road will be fuel-efficient, low-emissions hybrid vehicles. Now, sure, hybrid vehicles are more expensive today, but guess what? They don't have to be. If you put a little presidential muscle behind them, the doors of college were only open to the rich and powerful until President Lincoln pioneered a system of land-grant colleges that gave us UMass and URI and the University of Connecticut. After World War II, highways and roads were underfunded by local governments, and some were unusable until President Eisenhower put a little presidential muscle behind it and pushed through a national highway system. You want hybrid vehicles out on the highways of America, my friends? Make it affordable for Americans to buy hybrids, because that's a hell of a lot better than subsidizing Saudi sheiks who look the other way while madrasas teach kids how to hate and be violent. We can do better. Here's another bottom line. Good energy policy is fundamental to coping with global climate change. In 1992, I was part of the Senate delegation at the Rio Earth Summit. I was continuing an interest that Deb Callahan referred to in her introduction, sparked when I led the efforts in the 80s to deal with acid rain, efforts that culminated in our creating a cap-and-trade system for emissions and making it part of the Clean Air Act of 1990. I believe that George Herbert Walker Bush, Bush 41, can be proud that he was a President Bush who signed into law bills to help us reduce pollution. The story since then is not just a disappointment. It's a flagrant, dangerous, arrogant disavowal of science at the behest of the powerful. It is a damning story of public irresponsibility and private profiteering. And those who have encouraged, facilitated, and acquiesced in it will go down in history as modern-day robber barons who sold out future generations for their own selfish gain. We need to make certain that we use this November to throw the robber barons and their cronies out of Congress and put the people's interests back in. Each year since 1992, the science has become more certain. What was theory in some areas is now proven fact. Scientific models have become more sophisticated and more accurate. Across the world, scientists and national leaders, except ours, have spoken out and acted decisively. Only the United States stands out as a flat earth holdout for inaction. When confronted by scientific facts, leaders must not change the facts to suit their policies. Whether the issue is global warming, stem cell research, or Iraq, leaders owe the American people the truth. In the last month, Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth has brought the science to millions of Americans in a dramatic and persuasive way. Al was an early leader and a visionary on climate change, and if he had not just been elected, but had been inaugurated as president, America would be the world's leading advocate. America today would be the world's leading advocate, not the world's leading opponent of climate change. The question now, even more than it has been since 1992 when we all went down to Rio together, is not whether climate change is happening, but what are we going to do about it? And I don't mean how does the political system moan and groan and adopt makeshift responses. I mean, what are we really going to do about it? How do we turn this danger into opportunity? How do we meet a challenge of epic proportions with an epic American response? Well, you have to start by ending the bizarre disconnect of American politics. Real crises stare us in the face, screaming for solution, but non-existent, contrived ones replace the real ones on the agenda of Congress that wants to change the political climate instead of changing climate. They remain bent on dividing the country with flag-burning amendments or gay-bashing amendments to the Constitution when what we ought to be doing is strengthening our country, living by our Constitution with a determined attack on global climate change. Compare the craven politics that we see today to last week's announcement by the nation's leading climate scientists. A shocking new report that revealed that the Earth's temperature is at a 2,000-year high. The scientists said, and let me just read you, they said the recent warmth is unprecedented for at least the last 400 years and potentially the last several millennia. They also stated that human activities are responsible for much of the recent warming. So unless we deal with global warming boldly and quickly, our world is going to undergo a string of terrible events in the Atlantic, in the Pacific, across the planet, far worse than what we experienced with Katrina. Never before have so many people lived so close to the coasts. More than 100 million people worldwide live within 3 feet of mean sea level. Some of the world's greatest cities like New York, Shanghai, Bangkok, and Tokyo are actually at risk. So we need a plan that actually does what the science tells us we have to do to respond. And that's why I will be introducing in the Senate the most far-reaching proposal in our history. Nothing else will protect our security and our world if you believe the science. And I believe that anyone who knows the urgency of this global challenge will be fighting in order to make this a national policy. That's what I'm going to do. What I intend to do will stop and reverse U.S. emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. I propose establishing an aggressive, economy-wide cap-and-trade program to reverse emissions growth starting in 2010. After that, we will progress to more rapid reductions and end at 65% below 2000 level emissions by the year 2050. That is the only way to prevent the disaster. Now, at the same time, we can't be reckless about economic impacts. I understand that. We must ensure that American businesses remain competitive with the rest of the world. To achieve that goal, my plan will provide the tools to help the economy transition to new clean energy technologies, to protect workers and affected communities, and protect companies and consumers from energy cost shocks. We will provide tax incentives for good behavior and increased funding for research, development, and deployment of clean energy technologies. And I believe we should double the federal government funding for research and development to support private sector energy research, demonstration, and deployment. The United States is the world's single largest emitter of greenhouse gases. But the U.S. alone cannot solve the challenge of climate change. It is going to take action from other countries, both developed and developing. We must re-engage in discussions with the international community. We must come back to the table and work together to put a plan to take us forward. It's a global problem, and it's going to require a global response. So we have big challenges to solve, and a whole host of people in Washington who don't know how to tackle them, and a whole cast of political consultants who will counsel their candidates not to even try. That's where you come in. You need to push the curve. You need to do what we did in the 1970s when people went out and said, we're going to stop rivers from burning and toxic sites from poisoning people. You need to shake things up. A Saudi Arabian oil minister and a founder of OPEC once said that the Stone Age came to an end not for lack of stones, and the oil age will come to an end, but not for a lack of oil. We are not about to run out of oil, no, but the consequences of endless dependence on oil are simply too great, too profound, and too dangerous for our nation. Rather than have our energy policy be the last great mistake of the 20th century, we can and must create a policy that is the first great breakthrough of the 21st century. So for the second time in our history, let's declare and win our independence. This time not from foreign rule, but from foreign oil. If we are, as Lincoln said, the last best hope of Earth, let's stop being the denier of global warming that endangers the Earth. Let's give our people back the truth, and let's give the world back its future. Thank you.